Welcome to the News Roundup on WCAI. I'm Catherine Ident, in for Steve Junker. This is our weekly News Roundup. We're going to discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with some of my colleagues from print and digital media. Joining me in studio this morning is Gwen Friss from the Cape Cod Times. Good morning, Gwen.
Good morning, Katie.
Also joining us this hour will be George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times, Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner, Noah Asimo from the Vineyard Gazette. We'll also check in with Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle and Heather Goldstone, host of WCAI's Living Lab Radio. First, Gwen, I want to talk about a couple stories from the Cape Cod Times this week. Maybe a step forward after a lot of talk, and that's a federal bill looking to appropriate money for new bridges at the canal.
Yes, a lot of money, $5 million for the design of two new canal bridges. And what happened is that this is a story that came from Senator William Keating's office. U.S. Representative William Keating's office. And he was talking about the fact that the one of the House on Tuesday passed this amendment that will be included in an appropriations bill. And this amendment would bring $5 million to the Army, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, because it because of the fact that they own the bridges, essentially, and would be hiring the design for them.
Mm-hmm. Right. And the designs are not, it doesn't necessarily mean the designs are anywhere forthcoming, right?
Oh, no. In fact, it's sort of interesting that one of the ways that this was passed as one of the considerations was that it's listed as escape routes for the two bridges, in case in the past there's been talk about if there was any kind of an accident at Pilgrim Nuclear Plant, which is, of course, now being decommissioned but still has nuclear materials on it, because that would come across the water and there would not be a good, safe way to get off. And no, you're right. It still needs to go through the Senate, and then after that, we all know about commissioning, you know, getting the architects in place and public comment and all of that. So, but it's a step.
It is a step. And of course, there's been a lot of talk over the last few years here on the Cape. We have, you know, Wendy Northcross of the Cape Cod Chamber stepping up. And then most recently, a state report taking a look at the highways that, you know, lead up to the bridges on both sides, the mainland side and the Cape side. There's a lot of to consider. And of course, a lot of ideas, everything from, you know, multiple bridges to just a few with bigger lanes, but then questions about how the traffic would actually be directed, because we know, and probably today, we will see those typical summer backups heading on both bridges.
I didn't have a summer backup, but it was very slow going over the Bourne Bridge. I usually leave in, you know, an hour to get to you guys.
Yeah.
But, that and people, please be careful taking lefts. I can't tell you how many people were trying to take lefts.
It's tough on the Cape in the summer.
It is. I just give it up altogether. And absolutely, you know, we've seen such big changes at Sagamore over the past 10 years. You know, they're talking about the effectiveness of the rotaries. And those of us who travel them every day could probably add a little bit to that.
Right. But, yes. Much more discussion to be had. This really is a preliminary step, but still, I guess, heartening for those of us who are paying attention to what's happening at the bridges with all the repairs that are needed. They're old structures from the 1930s and what we hope to see in the future.
It definitely. And, you know, it's sort of like a process step, but yeah, you need the process to get started.
That's right. That's right. Other news this week, we had a wet spring, if we can recall. It's a little humid and sunny out there now, but a wet spring. And that's helped a lot of plants burst forth, including toxic algae in some Cape ponds.
Yes, you know, too much water, and there's not a lot you can do about that except wait for them to clear. And it's important to do that. You know, people and their pets were being advised this week to avoid all contact with water in three Cape Cod ponds, and because of bacterial blooms. And I'm going to try to say the name of the bacteria. bacterial bloom, which is cyanobacteria.
I think you got it.
Great. And they found blooms in Santuit Pond in Mashpee, Bierce Pond in Barnstable, and Upper Mill Pond in Brewster. So warnings were issued Friday for recreational users there. But other towns on the Cape are also seeing elevated levels and keeping an eye on whether the levels get to the point where people have to stay away. My understanding is that it can cause rashes, mm-hmm. and you can be very uncomfortable, or your dog, if you walk with your dog, can be very uncomfortable. So the Brewster Health Agent, Nancy Ellis Ice, said Monday that the advisory on Upper Mill Pond would likely be removed after the most recent testing showed that the levels had dropped. So it's really like a nature balancing kind mm-hmm. of thing.
Mm-hmm. Right. And this bacteria, this algae, toxic algae, doesn't just cause rashes. It can cause some more severe problems. So it's not something necessarily to be cavalier about and right. ignore these warnings. How does this happen? We know the rain is causing stuff to wash into these ponds.
Yes, and you know, rain washes nutrients, including septic effluent and lawn fertilizer, into ponds, and that promotes the growth. You know, the nitrogen in those discharges promote the growth of naturally occurring bacteria. So it might be there, but if it's under a certain level, it's not going to bother the users of the pond. Mm-hmm. There's you know, it's something that all the Cape towns have to keep an eye on, and I'm sure other places with a lot of water, you know. But in terms of being able to know if you're planning to go to the pond near your house or wherever you're renting when you're visiting, the Association for the Preservation of Cape Cod does, on their website, have a list and a map of the levels. And to get to that, you go to APCC.org/, and I'm going to spell this, CYANO.
Okay, so for cyano, for the bacteria.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Right, and there's about 1,000 ponds on the Cape, so, and not nearly all of them. In fact, just a tiny fraction of them are monitored. So you can check it out if you have a question, but if you have some doubts, I guess maybe stay out of the water for a little while until things kind of clear up and we have more sunny weather.
That seems to be happening pretty quickly. And actually, the Association to Preserve Cape Cod is monitoring 22 Cape ponds, which I think are the ones that are more heavily used for recreation.
All right. In other news, in Barnstable, officials there are facing a lawsuit by a local or a Massachusetts-based convenience store, gas store chain. And actually, it's Cumberland Farms, and they're suing a host of towns. Barnstable is one of them.
Yes, Barnstable and five other communities in Massachusetts. And what they're trying to do, all of those communities have put in place regulations that restrict the sales of flavored tobacco products. And what they're trying to do is to fight that move, because they say it will cost them up to 40% of their business. By flavored tobacco products, we're talking about everything from mentholated cigarettes to vaping products that use, like, you know, strawberry and I don't know them personally, but that use flavors that the towns are concerned that they appeal to younger people, and they're trying to sort of shut down that part of the stream, you know, to not have kids buying flavored tobacco products. So, for example, in Barnstable, the Board of Health voted last month to limit sales to places where you have to be 21 to get in, you know, bars, smoking, smoke shops, that kind of thing. So, there was a lot of pushback against that.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly from convenience stores like Cumberland Farms, and also a couple of others, you know, privately owned ones, because their point is that this is happening. It was scheduled to go into effect tomorrow, June 29th, and the store owner said, we've already bought our stock for the summer, you know, and this, we bought a lot, you know, so we're going to be stuck with all this stuff because it can't be returned.
Mm-hmm. Right. And also, too, Cumberland Farms is saying that they've collected 1,000 signatures just at the Barnstable stores. There's a few in town, in Barnstable, in Hyannis,
right.
I believe, asking for this regulation to be blocked. So now the as you said, the regulation, which was supposed to go into effect tomorrow, it's on hold. And, you know, now because of the civil action. So,
well, it essentially had been on hold so that they could talk about it some more because of these issues I was telling you about.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's definitely going to be held off while the litigation is in place. And also the Board of Health, I believe, will be reconsidering at their July 23rd meeting.
Okay. All right. We have an update in happenings with actor Kevin Spacey. He was accused of sexual assault on Nantucket a few years ago. He faces a criminal suit that's already kind of in progress, but now he also faces a civil lawsuit.
Yes, that was filed this week by the person in the criminal case.
The accuser.
And yes, the accuser. Thank you. I was looking for the right word. Spacey, you may not, if you don't know this, but his all of the court records are in his real name, which is Kevin Fowler. So he is is facing a criminal charge of indecent assault and battery. He allegedly groped a 18-year-old busboy at the club car in 2016. And now this civil suit has been filed, and the accuser has hired Mitchell Garabedian, who you may remember is known for representing representing victims in the Catholic priest sexual abuse scandal. He was featured in the movie Spotlight, so mm-hmm. got a lot of attention at that time.
That's a well-known name,
right? And so. There's a just to briefly go over the allegations. Spacey is accused of giving several drinks to the 18-year-old, and also to inviting him back and to having an encounter mm-hmm. with him, which involved groping.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Right. And this latest civil lawsuit is alleging severe and permanent mental distress and emotional injuries, along with financial loss associated with the incident.
Right. Because the teen couldn't work. People may also recall that the accuser is the son of former Boston reporter Heather Unruh.
That's right. Let's move on to another story just briefly, and that's out of Sandwich. And there's been an adventure park there that's undergone some controversy, has been shut down, and now the zoning board has given a permit for this park at Heritage Museum and Gardens.
That's right. This was kind of sudden and involved a little bit controversy. I mean, it has over the months as it came in, because the neighbors say that it's not far enough away from their homes and that it's potentially in an environmentally sensitive area. There's a 100-foot setback, and they are saying that it's not far. This
right.
whole
too close.
Thing is too close.
Yep.
It involves like a series of platforms and zip lines and things like that. So the just 32 minutes into Tuesday's hearing, the Zoning Board of Appeals addressed the subject, and Heritage attorney Eliza Cox submitted a new plan to the Zoning Board, designed to designed to bypass problems. We can't do a second take here.
We're live.
That's right. Board member Robert Jensen said the community requirement of it being educational was met because they were giving discounts to schools, and some people complained that it was actually a very light rewrite of what they had already had.
Mm-hmm.
But the board passed it, and despite objections from the neighbor's lawyer,
mm-hmm.
and
so it's going to reopen.
Looks like it's going to reopen, and they'll be swinging and climbing
zipping.
Zipping at Heritage.
And that is Gwen Friss from the Cape Cod Times, who joined me this morning to talk about some of the big stories in the Cape Cod Times this week. We have to take a break, but we'll be right back. Welcome back to the News Roundup on WCAI. I'm Catherine Iden, filling in for Steve Junker. We are talking about some of the top local news stories of the week with some of the region's leading journalists. Joining me on the phone now is George Brennan, news editor at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Katie. How are you?
I'm well. You must be busy. It's kind of a big news week for you on the island. Top story, the strike, the Vineyard Transit Authority bus drivers.
Yeah, so the drivers for, this is the year-round drivers for the VTA have been saying that a strike was a real possibility. They took a strike vote in the spring. And an authorization, and this week they said it was time. They had just reached an impasse with TCI, which is the parent company for the drivers, and this morning they are indeed out on strike in Vineyard Haven. They're out picketing. Interestingly, we had reporters both in Vineyard Haven and Edgartown this morning. Over in Edgartown, it seemed like business as usual because the drivers are concentrating on Vineyard Haven this morning. Some people I reported spoke to in Edgartown, visitors, had no idea that there was a strike even going on. Their VTA is filling in with both managers and seasonal drivers. They say they're going to try and keep as many of the routes going as possible. One of the drivers told our reporter, you know, we'll probably be able to keep up with service during the day, but night's going to be kind of dicey for them. Interestingly, our reporter in Vineyard Haven observed that people are walking right past the picket line and onto the buses, both commuters and visitors. The thing is, people really don't have other ways to get around here. If they're coming in on a ferry, you know, the options are limited. You either take the bus or you take a cab or an Uber, and obviously those are a lot more limited than, say, one of these VTA buses that carries many more passengers.
Mm-hmm. That's a little bit surprising. I know we talked for Morning Edition, George, and there was speculation that perhaps people might make the decision not to cross the picket line. But as you just said, they might feel like they have no choice because their lives must go on.
Yeah, you know, one of our reporters spoke to a couple visiting from California, and they said, while we sympathize and empathize with these drivers, we have a boat to catch and, you know, a connection to make it to a flight out of Logan Airport. So they felt bad about it, but indeed they had to cross the picket line in order to get to their ferry and, you know, make all their connections.
Mm-hmm. Remind us, George, briefly of why they are on strike.
Yeah, so it's interesting. You know, they've been back and forth for about 5 years now. The year-round drivers wanted to form a union, and there was some pushback on that. They did finally form a union, but they had difficulty getting the parent company initially to come to the bargaining table. They have since come to the bargaining table, but they can't reach an agreement. And it, of course, it comes down to money, but it also comes down to language as well in the contract. So there are some sticking points. The drivers don't feel as if they're earning enough money, especially here on the island where it is a lot more expensive to live. The starting wage is similar to what it is on the Cape and other places, but the cost of living here, of course, is a lot more than those other places. So they're asking for more money, and there's some bus drivers who haven't gotten a raise in 5 years.
Certainly a story we will be checking in with you and keeping an eye on as it develops. And briefly, George, it is the summer season. We're heading into a busy holiday weekend, and that means there's a lot more people on the Vineyard, also meaning there are a lot more emergency calls. Just briefly.
That's right. We feel like we're taking in news through a fire hose here. there have been a lot of things going on. Couple of boat fires, a couple of house fires, someone hit the gas instead of the brake and went into a Kronig store. You know, fortunately, in most of these, there have been no injuries. There was one particularly tragic case where, you know, someone was hanging out of on a roof of a car and fell off that car.
Ooh.
And had to be airlifted to a Boston hospital. And that last we heard, that person was in very serious condition. So, you know, you put 100,000 people on an island that typically has 15,000 people, and there are going to be more accidents, there are going to be more fires, and everybody's gearing up for it because it isn't even 4th of July yet.
That's right. And your newsroom sounds busy. George, I'm going to let you get back to it. Thank you for checking in with us with these updates.
Thanks so much, Katie. Have a good weekend.
You too. That's George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times. I want to turn now and take a look at news out of the Cape Cod Chronicle with Tim Wood. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning.
Tim, in Chatham, fishermen are getting more and more upset over some construction delays at the Chatham Fish Pier. What's been going on?
Yeah, well, the construction has been going on since earlier this year, and officials now are considering suspending construction, which would be fine with the fishermen. They say continuing the work could interfere with the way they with their use of the facilities. Now, the work involved a number of different aspects, replacing fuel tanks and paving some parking areas. Most importantly, the replacement of the popular observation deck at the pier. But the work right now is about 2 months behind schedule. And the contractor said that, you know, wet weather this spring and some change orders by the town put them behind. But the town is also pointing fingers at the contractor, Siaba Construction of Walpole, because there have been many days where they had one or two people on the job and they just haven't seemed to be pushing the project much. And this week, the focus has been on getting the parking lot that the fishermen used cleared so that the fishermen can have access down there. And the fishermen say that, you know, they would want work on the observation deck to be halted for the summer because they're concerned that if the observation deck is above the offloading area where they work, and they're concerned that, you know, you can't have a construction project going where you're basically processing food. So they've asked the town to halt that the rest of the construction until the fall because the fish are here, the fishermen are working in earnest, and they need access and really they need that place cleared out. And the fishermen, the big problem, of course, is the observation deck draws thousands of people a day during the summer. Without that there's a question about where people are going to go because they're still going to come to the fish pier. Are they going to be wandering around the facility? The town is working on getting extra staff down there to kind of keep people away from the what is essentially an industrial processing facility. And we're expecting this coming week on Monday, the selectmen are going to get an update, and we fully expect them to say, okay, go ahead, shut everything down for the summer, and we'll revisit this in the fall.
Okay. In Harwich, despite the urging of more than 100 residents, the planning board has decided to wait to refer a proposed retail facility to the Cape Cod Commission for review. So what information do they feel they're lacking?
Well, they feel that they don't have the adequate documentation to make a discretionary referral to the commission on a couple of issues related to neighborhood character and traffic. This involves a 7,489 square foot retail project in West Harwich. It's right in the middle of an area that the residents are in that neighborhood are looking at establishing a historic district. There's a bunch of very old and beautiful historic captains' houses in the area. In fact, there's one on this property that's in disrepair that the developer has proposed taking down. And the residents really want this to go to the Cape Cod Commission because the planning board really can't do anything to stop the project or condition it because it's in a commercially zoned area. But the Cape Cod Commission, of course, would have more regulatory power if they received a discretionary referral. So the planning board has asked their staff to develop that documentation, and they are expected to come back and make a formal vote on July 9th.
All right. So we've got some news to catch up on when we talk with you again soon, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We appreciate this update.
Okay, thanks. Have a good weekend.
You too. I want to take a look at news happening on the Outer Cape. I have Ed Miller on the line from the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Ed. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Katie and Gwen.
So there was some praise and criticism of a $1 million anonymous donation this week to buy tidal flats in Wellfleet. It turned out to be a gift from a town official.
Yes, that's right. And this is a kind of convoluted and somewhat mind-boggling story.
Yes. We can try to keep
bear
it.
Bear with me here. So the background here is, of course, Wellfleet's shell fishing is a major town industry employing, some people think, around 10% of the year-round residents and producing $6 million or more a year in revenue. And another piece of important information is that in Massachusetts, unlike every other state, The intertidal zone, that is the area between the mean high tide and the mean low tide lines, can be privately owned, and much of it is. And, of course, that's the area where aquaculture and wild picking of oysters and clams goes on. So it turns out that about 20 years ago, a large area of Wellfleet's shellfish flats off of Indian Neck were in question because a landowner on the shore claiming ownership of the flats tried to stop people from doing aquaculture there, didn't like to look at their trucks and gear and all of that. And a group of local shell fishermen, with the aid of an extremely crafty Boston lawyer named Ed Englander, managed to acquire about 250 acres or so of the flats and beach for the sum of $25,000. Well, this year, one of the selectmen in Wellfleet, Helen Miranda Wilson, decided that it was really important for the town to own that tide land, that bottom land. And she came to the selectmen, the rest of the selectmen in March, with a message from the owners of the flat saying that they would sell it to the town for $3.4 million. Well, people at that point said, wait a minute, that's, you know, it sounds like a good idea for the town to own it, but that's an awful lot of money. What ended up happening was that the sellers reduced their price eventually to $2 million, and town administrator Dan Hort announced that there was an offer, an anonymous offer of $1 million to sweeten the deal so that it would really cost the town only $1 million. And with those assurances, the town meeting voted for this purchase, and it was passed at the town election as well, a debt exclusion under Prop 2.5. Nevertheless, many people were uncomfortable with the way the whole thing went down, and the Banner made a public records request of the town to disclose the name of the donor. They denied it. We appealed that to the state supervisor of records, and the town was ordered to reveal the name. And it turned out that it was Selectman Helen Miranda Wilson, who had, it turned out, inherited a great deal of money, she said, from her partner of 47 years, who died in January 2018. Well, so everybody knows Helen in town. She is an extremely remarkable character who was born here, who has served as a selectman and in many other capacities in town. And people were kind of blown away by the magnanimity of the gift. At the same time, she had not recused herself as would have been required under the conflict of interest law from all of these dealings. And on top of that, many people voted for the purchase with the understanding that there would be an independent appraisal done by the town of the value of these flats, because there's a lot of questions about how do you value shellfish flats.
Of course, yeah.
And it turned out on last Friday, when all of this broke, when Helen Wilson revealed herself as the anonymous donor under orders from the state, and the three members of the Board of Selectmen then signed the purchase and sale agreement. At that same meeting, they revealed that there was no contingency in the purchase and sale for an independent appraisal. They relied instead, they said, on a six-year-old appraisal that had been done for the owners of the flats, which showed supposedly that they're worth $4 or $5 million. Well, a lot of people are unhappy with that. They say that you cannot rely on a six-year-old appraisal done for the seller. You've got to do an independent appraisal. And that's kind of where we stand right now.
Oh, man. A complicated, as you said, a complicated story. But, you know, it's about these tidal flats. It's important for the livelihoods of people in town. And, of course, a well-known town official there trying to act out of generosity. Things kind of getting bound up in process. Ed, you did a great job sussing it out for us and explaining it. We appreciate it. Have a great weekend.
Well, thanks, Katie. Same to you.
Thank you. That's Ed Miller of the Provincetown Banner. And I want to turn now to some other news out of Martha's Vineyard. Talk to Noah Asimo of the Vineyard Gazette. Good morning, Noah.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for joining us. Big news that kind of broke yesterday, and that's a historic and ecologically important estate in Aquinnah is for sale for $65 million. The owner of that estate, quite famous.
Yes. So, surprise, the owner is Caroline Kennedy and the Kennedy family.
Mm-hmm.
The property is called Redgate Farm, and it's being sold as a whole, as you said, with an asking price of $65 million. Please let that sink in for a second. It's a lot of
gather
money.
Gather your pennies, yeah.
Right, exactly. You know, put them all together. It's right, but so, you know, a lot of money, of course, but the legacy of the property and the site's, you know, natural heritage makes it pretty much unparalleled. It encompasses 340 acres of what is pretty much unspoiled, windswept coastal dunes. It has wetlands. It has heathlands, and it pretty much takes up the entire area between Squibnocket Pond and Moship Trail up in Aquinnah. So anyone who's driven down Moship Trail on their left, that's the property. Of course, you can't see a large portion of it, but what you do get to experience is pretty much undeveloped land all along what is one of the most rare ecological sites, you know, not just on the island, but actually in the world.
That's right. I was going to say, you know, of course, there's the structure on it, which has historic relevance because, you know, Jackie spent
right.
a lot of time there. But as you're saying, I mean, there's a lot of people paying attention to the natural beauty and importance of some different species on this piece
right.
of land.
So, I mean, the property has beachfront access. It's home to these rare species that actually, I think over the years, biologists have gotten special permission to go up and study. It has a rare species of orchid that pretty much doesn't exist. You know, it's there. Like, a lot of the island has become developed since the property was purchased in the 70s, but now it's still a habitat for the northern harrier hawk. And I believe the Mass Natural Heritage has designated it as one of the most ecologically important sites in the Commonwealth.
Wow.
And
you, the Gazette got a letter from Caroline Kennedy talking about her mother's love for the place and also talking a little bit about why they were motivated to put it on the market.
Yeah, so we received this beautiful letter from Caroline, who, of course, is Jackie's daughter. It described how Jackie bought the property in 1978 for $1 million, and she tells the story about how Jackie always kind of thought, you know, she was proud of herself because she thought it was a shrewd real estate investment. Clearly, it's paying off now.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, the property itself was really part of a larger, widespread sort of private land conservation effort that was popular on the island in the 70s. Jackie bought the property right after Katharine Graham, who some might know as the former publisher of the Washington Post, bought her Mohu estate on the north side of the island. The land remained in private hands, but conservation was really a huge part of the purchase. And in Caroline's letter, she describes why the property was so important to Jackie. You know, if you don't mind, if I read a little excerpt to you.
just briefly, we just have about 20 seconds left.
No worries. She said she loved the old stone walls, the blue heron that lived in the pond behind the dunes, the hunting cabin that was the only thing on the property when she acquired it, the clay cliffs, the Wampanoag legends. She would bike up to the Gay Headlight every morning, and then she would check the tide on the chart so she could jog. So really, it's just this quintessential sort of Aquinnah property, and that's how Jackie Kennedy used it.
Yes.
And it'll have a new steward now, but hopefully one who still values it for the beautiful land that it is.
And there's a detailed story in the Vineyard Gazette for those who would like to see some photos and read more about this property. Noah Asimo, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Have a great weekend. Bye-bye. And we need to take a break, but we'll be back with more local and regional news after this. Welcome back to The Point. It's the news roundup, where each Friday we take a look at the top local and regional news stories of the week. I'm Catherine Ident, filling in for Steve Junker. Beacon Hill lawmakers admitted this week that avoiding a legislative logjam right before the budget is due, which happens to be Monday, doesn't look likely. I caught up with WCAI Statehouse reporter Mike Dean to talk about this and some of the other priorities lawmakers might tackle in the next month before they recess in August. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Catherine.
Mike, what happened? You know, you and I had talked just recently about the fact that lawmakers were trying to put together budgets that were pretty standard so that there wasn't a lot of controversy and they could get this done. So how did it go off the rails?
Yeah, well, I guess you can classify this one as kind of a normal dysfunction, where we're within the realm of possibility here.
Oh.
But yes, legislative leaders have said that they're not going to get the budget done before that July 1st deadline. Now, they have passed a temporary budget to cover the month of July. However, that big FY 2020 budget plan that we always hear so much about and how important it is isn't going to get done. And you're right, they tried to make things a lot easier this year and make it a kind of no-frills, no-splash budget so that they could avoid what happened last year, which was the budget negotiations between the House and the Senate went on for an awfully long time into the summer, and that took a lot of the oxygen out of the room for practically everything else. And a number of big, big ticket items like education reform, education funding, I should say, and healthcare reform, things like that, just kind of went by the wayside because of that the budget occupying all that space and the attention of lawmakers. So I don't know what happened this time. It seems like, you know, I know the sticking points going into the budget were about UMass tuition. There were differences between the chambers on taxing vape products, things like that. But they weren't too far apart. So, yeah, I guess I would kind of consider it normal operating dysfunction for Beacon Hill to be a little bit after their deadline.
But also, too, I wonder, with all the problems that the MBTA has been having, and of course, here on the Cape, it doesn't necessarily affect our daily lives, but we certainly pay into the system, and it's hard to ignore the dysfunction that's happening up there. And so if you've got this budget talk happening later than usual, plus this other issue, is it really going to kind of force lawmakers to prioritize what they're going to get done in this session?
Short answer is yes. And I think we saw some of that urgency this week when Speaker DeLeo put out a statement saying that he would dedicate immediate funding for the MBTA. That's something that was kind of new. For the longest time, everyone has had the same plan when it comes to the MBTA. And that is, Charlie Baker, the governor, wants to spend the amount that they already have, but spend it better over a long period of time. He thinks that plan is sufficient. Democratic lawmakers have insisted on raising revenues to get there. A lot of the moderate leaders maybe dragging their feet a little bit until they found that those new revenues were necessary. Now, pretty much everybody, including DeLeo, is on board that this round of tax raising that's going to be debated either this fall or over the winter needs to be, at least some portion of it needs to be dedicated to the MBTA and transportation projects in general. The other side of that coin is education. Another thing where Democrats see that there needs to be an infusion of new revenue dollars to, make the funding formula that brings funding to cities and towns and district schools, make that more equitable.
And I would point out here too, Mike, that the education issue is not just something that they want to prioritize. There are cities and towns that are getting fed up with this and are threatening lawsuits. So, you know, you've got the MBTA pressure because of real problems, and then you've got actually some real problems, I would say, with the education issue.
Absolutely. And if, you know, you want to zoom out, and if you're from the kind of liberal democratic point of view, the answer to both of these problems is to raise taxes and put more money into these systems, both education and transportation. That's something that we've been talking about for years, but it's really coming to a head. DeLeo wants to spend some supplementary, that's kind of existing revenue money in the budget, on the MBTA in the immediate aftermath of that red line derailment to kind of pump some cash into the system there. But yeah, I think this winter is going to be absolutely occupied by the tax talk, what taxes to raise and how much to spend on transportation and education annually going forward. This isn't going to be a one-time thing. We're going to be talking about funding transportation at a much higher level every single year, and the same goes for education.
And you mentioned this winter, and we are at the beginning of the summer, and there is an August recess. So we're now looking at, because of this, you know, the lack of the budget being done by Monday, which is the start of the new fiscal year, it's like a domino effect.
Yeah, and usually July is a time when the legislature has a little bit of energy to get something done. Usually the immediately after the July 4th break, everyone kind of gets back and says, well, what can we do? I asked Speaker DeLeo and Senate President Karen Silka about this earlier this week, and they didn't really have any straight answer for me. DeLeo said that he'd ask his chairman and see what bills are kind of ready to go But that kind of talk leads me to believe that it's not going to be a hugely significant item or piece of legislation. So we're not going to see some kind of transportation deal or a healthcare deal even, and certainly not that education bill until much later in the fall. It could be some kind of B or C level work. They'll be here. They'll be doing stuff. But it's not going to be any of those big ticket items that we've been talking about that kind of dominate the conversation.
And that's not even, I guess, to mention Governor Charlie Baker, who would like to push the housing issue, which, of course, we hear all the time. We have a housing kind of shortage, and housing is very expensive. We just had a report out this week about problems in the greater Boston area and getting affordable housing passed in cities and towns. And I know that's one of Baker's agenda items, but are they going to get to that?
Probably not. Not this summer. I can't really see that happening. There is, again, an ongoing debate about this. And the way the legislature works is they don't really work things out on the floor. A lot of the committees and chairmen do a lot of this kind of work behind the scenes. They take temperatures of members and the leaders, see what everyone wants, and, stakeholders outside the building, certainly. Baker's bill, he says it's kind of a first step, and it doesn't have to be limited to what he wants. But what he wants to do is basically make it easier for cities and towns to approve zoning changes to get more dense building going up. Right now, you need a two-thirds majority at the town level, like of a select board, for instance. This would make it a strict majority, 50% or more, meaning that you could developers could more easily start building. And the problem here, though, is that a lot of Democrats don't think that's far enough. They want to do a more comprehensive bill that protects access to affordable housing. It will be fine to build a lot more, but it's not going to become affordable for another 25, 30 years, once that property ages into the affordability category, so to speak. So a lot of Democrats want to hit the brakes on the governor's plan, maybe include that local approval portion in whatever bill they eventually end up passing. But they want to do a much larger comprehensive look that includes things like affordable housing and where different programs go, what's successful and what's not so far, and do a more of a top-down reworking of state housing policy. And that is going to take a lot more time. So, yep, now we're looking at not necessarily the summer, maybe not the fall, maybe into the winter for that one as well.
I want to switch gears away from the timeline that we're looking at. You were at an event this week that garnered some news attention, and that was a hearing and a rally regarding the notion of aid in dying, which opponents call assisted suicide. Tell us about that hearing and what went on.
Well, to start with this one, we have to go back to 2012. If you remember, voters on the ballot in 2012 narrowly defeated a provision that was going to allow doctors to prescribe lethal amounts of medication to a patient who had been diagnosed with 6 months or less to live. So that's what we're dealing with here. It would be basically the law would change to let doctors give a patient voluntarily, so that then the patient could voluntarily take them pills that would end their life if they are diagnosed with 6 months to live, with a mental health evaluation and a waiting period. That's what this legislation would do. It is obviously a topic close to a lot of folks' hearts. The room in Gardner Auditorium here at the State House was packed kind of with advocates on both sides. Arguing whether or not this is discriminatory, if it is a violation of civil rights to disabled people to have an option like this on the table. And it is something that, because voters weighed in, even though it was very narrow in 2012, the legislature is slow to take a topic like this up again. They kind of feel like it has been said, even though it's been a few years. So I would expect that if this moves, it's going to take an awful lot of public opinion and maybe polling to get it the urgency it needs to get on the Beacon Hill radar.
And I want to mention, too, that it got some coverage here on the Cape because we do have a retired doctor in the region who has been an advocate and was up there this week on Beacon Hill advocating for aid in dying, suffering from advanced prostate cancer. That's Roger Kligler of Falmouth. And that is WCAI State House reporter Mike Dean. He's talking to us from Beacon Hill. Mike, thanks so much.
Hey, thanks. Great to be with you.
Joining me in studio now is Heather Goldstone, host of Living Lab Radio and our science correspondent here at WCAI. Good morning, Heather.
Good morning.
Heather, I want to talk about another big story that's been in the news several times this week, including an update, and that has to do with the North Atlantic right whales.
Yeah, so they're no longer in our waters. You know, they spend a lot of time in the spring in Cape Cod Bay, and this year we saw them south of the islands. They're now up in the Gulf of St. Lawrence area in Canadian waters, and this is an area where in 2017 there were at least 12 deaths there. There were 18 deaths that year in total, and 12 of those were in Canadian waters. Last year, there were no deaths, and it was hoped that, okay, maybe we put in place the protections necessary to prevent another year like that. But unfortunately, we've now had 6 deaths in the past month in Canadian waters in this one area, 1 very early in the month, and then 5 just in the past week.
5 is a lot when you consider the population hovers right over 400 left in the world.
Right. So we're talking about 1.5% of the population has died in the past month. That's not something that this population can sustain.
And this is, they're close to shipping lanes?
Yeah. So what's going on this year, and it's interesting, one researcher from Dalhousie has actually mapped where whales were sighted last year and where they've been sighted this year. And it looks really different. They're in the same general area at kind of the end of the Gulf of St. Lawrence. But last year, they kind of clustered in this almost north-south line where the very northern tip of that line was right near a busy shipping channel. This year, they're kind of spread out along an east-west line, and it's right along the edge of a shipping channel. Mm-hmm. And what we are seeing so far from the necropsies that have come in with a cause of death is, in one case, punctuation, an adult female, one of the best reproducers that the population has had, I think 8 calves. She was a confirmed grandmother. It wasn't even blunt force trauma in this case. It was sharp trauma. The strip strike actually punctured her body cavity. It's looking like this year what we're seeing is a ship strike problem, whereas in 2017 it appeared to be probably a combination of ship strikes but also entanglement in fishing gear.
So you mentioned that last year when we didn't see this type of event, mortality incident happen, people thought, great, our rules and regs are working. Can this be changed? This is in Canadian waters. Of course, here in the U.S., we pay particular attention because we see them specifically in Cape Cod Bay. But how fast can officials work to get on top of this?
Well, so they are working to get on top of it. And DFO, Department of Fisheries and Oceans, which is the Canadian equivalent of like our NOAA, has put in place at this point a speed limit for vessels over 20 meters, so over like 60, 65 feet, a 10 nautical mile speed limit in that Gulf of St. Lawrence area. There had already been some speed limits in restricted areas. So this is a broadening of that to try to address this ship strike issue. And they had also made some changes to fisheries restrictions in that area. So they can respond quickly. They are trying to respond. Part of the issue, at least in 2017, is that this is kind of a new area for the right whales to be showing up in these numbers. And so the protections hadn't been in place. This is definitely testing both here, where they're shifting in American waters, where they're shifting around where they're found, and also shifting into Canadian waters. You know, as their migration routes are changing, we now think in response to climate change and changes in their food sources resulting from ocean warming, it does really stretch the capabilities of our bureaucracies to move dynamically and start putting in place rules and protections in a really dynamic way.
Mm-hmm. And you, of course, in your reporting have talked to researchers who have spent many years of their life, some of whom almost know the whales personally, have named them. And, you know, it's a grieving process as we watch the population it dwindle.
It really is. I mean, so one person that I spoke with yesterday said you could kind of compare it to the motorcycle crash in New Hampshire, where 7 people were killed from one motorcycle club. And what we've seen in the past month is 6 individuals, all of whom have names. A friend of mine who is a researcher, you know, the other night was saying that one of those individuals is an individual that she named. And a lot of the researchers, yeah, this is every time one of these sightings comes in. It is a grieving process.
Mm-hmm. And that's Dr. Heather Goldstone, host of Living Lab Radio here on WCAI, and also our science correspondent. Heather, thank you for coming in. Sad news, but great to hear perspective and get an update.
And we'll be staying on top of it.
We are out of time. I want to thank my guests this hour, Gwen Friss of the Cape Cod Times, George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times, Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner, Noah Asimo from the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, and Heather Goldstone, of course, host of Living Lab Radio. I'm Catherine Iden, in for Steve Junker. I want to thank you for listening.